You're tuned into another episode of the Hinted Neuron Podcast. And as always, I'm your host, Kelvin Pascal. This week, you'll listen to me talk with Phyllis Levitt. Phyllis was a psychotherapist for 30 years before she retired. She's also an author. She has 3 books. One of her books currently is on sale right now, which is her newest book, American Therapy, which we talked on the most. She talks about mental health, well-being, using therapy as a way to avert violence within ourselves and, you know, within families and within societies. We had a wonderful conversation on mental health, therapy, well-being, and wellness as it concerns societies and people in general. Well, I hope you enjoy my conversation with her. I also had a good time talking to her as well. As always, if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, don't forget to reach out to me on Instagram or Twitter at Hinted Neuron. And now, here's my conversation with Phyllis Levitt. I am here with Phyllis Levitt. Phyllis, thank you for coming on the podcast. Phyllis is a retired psychotherapist and she's an author. She has 2 books and I think one currently on sale right now, pre-order right now, which is called America in Therapy. So Phyllis is a retired psychotherapist and she writes a lot online about mental health, therapy, and society as in general as it concerns the themes within mental health and well-being. Phyllis, I would pass the mic to you right now so that you can quickly talk about yourself.
Well, thank you so much for having me here to talk with you and share specifically about my new book, America in Therapy. And basically what that's about is bringing the best of what I have learned from the field of psychotherapy and psychology, and especially about how family systems work that influence us so greatly, taking that lens and of our understanding about what are some of the elements of a healthy family and what are some of the elements of a dysfunctional or abusive and neglectful family, and how can we take that understanding and look at what's going on in America and really what's going on around the world, but I focus on America because that's where I live, to see what's going on here through a psychological lens rather than an ideological lens, rather than a who's right and who's wrong lens, who's good and who's bad, but a lens of how do we heal this? How do we bring people back together? How do we create better communication, deeper understanding, and a commitment to work together to solve some of our huge societal and worldwide issues, which is what the best psychotherapy does. It helps people reconnect to themselves in a healthy way and reconnect to the other people around them in relational ways, or work out their disagreements without violence, even if they just have to part in peace. But the best psychotherapy really helps heal our relationship with ourselves and with other people. And in that sense, it's nonpartisan. It's not about left or right. It's not about blue or red. It's really about how do we come together healthfully to work out the issues that we face, which are obviously huge issues that we face today as a nation.
Yeah, thank you for that really good introduction. There's a lot to unpack there. There's like a lot I want to get into. I think, you know, one of the ways I want to open the Pandora box is I think there's an article I read, I think last week, something, because you talked about family and I wanted to, you know, get your perspective on that. There was like a disappearance of the dining table from the American home, and that which itself like removes community from, you know, the American person, maybe a single family home. I want to talk about that because I'm fascinated with, or I'm maybe a bit obsessed with community and loneliness and how that's slowly disappearing and how that affects well-being and mental health for people and society as a whole.
Well, absolutely. I mean, so, you know, everything that I talk about is like looking at the microcosm of the family and the macrocosm of the family of America or of larger institutions or even of the world, because they are reflections of one another. And having been a therapist for over 30 years and working so deeply with the early conditioning of the people that I worked with and my own, of course, in the personal work that I've done myself, what I really do, I do really see the breakdown of a feeling of belonging and a feeling of the, even the importance of coming together in person without devices, without distractions, without the TV on, without our phones, and really connecting on a very personal level. I think what one of the basic things that I've learned as a psychotherapist is that the very best emotional food for human beings is a feeling of love, belonging, safety, being provided for, feeling valued, and a commitment among people to cooperate with one another and to resolve their issues and their conflicts and their disagreements without violence. And those are the, you know, there's probably other things I could add to that list, but those are sort of the fundamentals of what make up a healthy family, that there's really a commitment to work things out that has an eye on what's good for the whole and what's good for the individual, so that they're in a constant dialogue and constant balance. And it's not like the good of the individual overcomes the good of the family, or some perceived good for the family doesn't take into account the needs and individuality of the people in the family. And these are all our basic understanding of healthy family dynamics. And are they happening in our country? And if they're not happening in our country, why is that? And what could we do to bring us back to the table to really work together, even if we have big differences of opinion or different backgrounds or different traditions or different values or different sexual orientation or whatever it is we have? Because in a healthy family, people are committed to working those things out. And it's not necessarily easy, but it can be done.
Yeah, that's a really interesting view. I wanted to touch on the concept of family. You know, I know you've been in the field for a long amount of time. Do you think that family is one of the major, you know, I guess there are degrees to which things affect certain type of like problems or like individuals or like people? Do you think that to a very large degree that family plays a major role in maybe certain things like the self, or like where the self-motivation or self-drive or like even self healing in some ways? Do you think that that's mostly something that someone has to do, you know, in the broader community, in society, or within mostly in a family unit?
Oh, 100%. I mean, 100%. Our early conditioning, whether it's in our family of origin, is usually critical. And that may mean mother and father and siblings. It may mean grandparents. It may mean extended family. It may mean whoever a person grows up depending on for being brought up, and who they depend on to meet the necessities of their life. And more people are dependent on a wider range of people to actually survive. And there's a wider and wider range of people who have a profound influence on us, whether we're children or adults. And that's partly because there's so much access to immediate news and input and movies and books and social media that the influences extend far beyond the nuclear family. But the nuclear family itself, or whoever raises a person, has everything to do with the messages that they send. You know, what are the role models of behavior? How is conflict worked out in the family of origin? What are the role models for a relationship between men and women, between parents and children? What are the values around money, around religion, around our sexual orientation, around what constitutes success? What are the rewards and punishments for different behaviors? What are the expectations? We learn all these things from the people that we're closest to and that we depend on. And if the messages are basically healthy, you're loved, you're safe, you're wanted, when you step out of line, the boundaries are imposed in a firm but loving way, and you're not given a message that you're a bad person or worthless or not wanted. if there's a relative health and well-being in the family, then you grow up with people who have internalized that and are able to be those kinds of partners and parents and coworkers and bosses themselves. And when people grow up with abuse and neglect, and when they're told terrible things about themselves, or they're beaten, or there's sexual abuse, or they're kicked out, or they're not wanted by their schoolmates, or, you know, for the color of their skin, or their religion, or their gender, or whatever, then they internalize. I mean, we know all this in the field of psychology. I didn't make this up. This is basic psychology. We internalize not only the messages we receive about ourselves, but also models of behavior. So if people in your family hit each other when they were mad, that's what you've internalized about how people deal with conflict. If you live in a family where people just never talk about the problems, then you've internalized avoidance. And that's what you might take with you out into the world. If you've internalized, you know, some healthy role model of people actually sitting down and talking through their issues, and more or less, because we are imperfect human beings, listening to one another and being committed to coming back to some kind of resolution and reconnection with one another, then you're likely to take that with you out into the world. And so our early conditioning, I think, is profoundly important. And I think families are really suffering in America today. I think families are highly stressed economically. You know, when I was a kid, I didn't know anybody who had two working parents. And I think it's unusual now for there not to be two working parents and not to have somebody necessarily at home, and not necessarily for parents to be able to afford adequate childcare. Problems in the school system, who's there to deal with them? So I think families are stressed economically. I think they're stressed in our culture because the pressures on adults to look good and achieve and, you know, be successful for outer appearances often overcome the need for actual personal connection.
Pretty good point. I there are like two things you talked about. I wanted to, you know, maybe expand on in what you were talking about. Then one of them was the, you know, describing a model place where someone can feel safe and loved, and, you know, they would grow up in to be better people. And it's like, are there normally deviations from those type of assumptions where, you know, people had these type of spaces and they had, you know, the love, the compassion, the care, and they grew up in within good communities, but still, you know, you see them maybe in therapy that they maybe didn't turn out too well adjusted in those, you know, I don't know if there's stories like that and why that could be the case.
Oh, I just want to be clear. Why someone might grow up in a loving home but still have a lot of difficulty? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Adjusting, yeah. You know, really well.
Yeah. Well, there's no one size fits all for human beings. I think we're all actually unique, even though there are patterns we can identify about conditioning and expected, you know, human behaviors as a result of certain ways that we're treated. But we are all different. And there's differences in people's physiological and biochemical makeup. There's differences in what they're exposed to outside the home. So what they're exposed to in school and on the playground and in the workplace and on the internet today, which can be so unregulated, some of the influences for young people are so toxic. They're so destructive. They're so violent. They're so hateful, or so, you know, playing on people's insecurities and trying to have, you know, young people trying to look good, even when they don't feel good. So there's so many influences that are come in on us that, yes, you can be brought up in a loving home and still have difficulty growing up or really have problems that you have to address later on. And that's why I wrote the book America in Therapy, because America is made up of individuals. We are the family of America, all of us. And so we're together responsible for the family environment that we're creating for our children, for ourselves, for young people. And I think we have to take that responsibility on as a group. And that doesn't mean like imposing some kind of moral standard on other people. It means coming together and really listening to what people need and having respect for one another and working out our differences in a way that models that our problems can be resolved by sitting down at the table in peace and in respect for one another, which we're not doing right now. And so the role models that children see on television and social media are very, a lot of them, certainly not all, but a lot of them are very invested in promoting sort of a bravado of hating one another and putting other people down and beating each other at some kind of race rather than coming together in some kind of loving cooperation and respect for one another, which is what we all really want in our own lives. None of us want to be the target of somebody else's hate or violence, but somehow we tolerate that as a society. So that disconnect between what we want in our own lives and what we tolerate and even promote on larger social levels is a mental health issue. It's actually an issue of our mental health. And we're being conditioned to believe that it's an ideological condition division that's justified. And that's not the bottom line. That's a symptom, not the cause.
Yeah, this is all pretty interesting because, you know, I used to think about this a lot, the concept of, you know, if you simply define it like as an us versus them thing, you know, it's like, you know, an us versus them thing as this is that person and this is my people or that people. And
right.
It's like,
right.
You know, and it's predominant in the social media sphere, you know, and it's like,
very much.
I used to think, you know, why do people think, like, you know, they don't really see another person as a, you know, complex human being that's like them as well. It's like, that's like another thing or another person that's different from me in a way that I cannot maybe accept. And I used to think it was more political than, more political than mental, like, thing where, you know, people can, you know, come together to heal that type of mindset. But something that I wanted to touch on was the concept of social media, you know, even really as a whole now, because I think it probably might even get more worse with the influx of AI and I think it's a pretty serious thing, especially for young kids growing up, mm-hmm. how they would think, the things they would see, how they would hear, because, you know, even some things right now are no longer real. For me,
right.
who, like, you know, grew up learning how to filter, how to differentiate what's real and what's not real, sometimes I still get tricked. You know?
Right, it's right, because like, so it's crazy. Intense, so, yeah. Right.
Yes. So it's like, even for a young child, it's like, that's crazy. So I want to hear some of your views on that.
Yeah, I think really where that fits for me, I mean, I think social media is a blessing and a curse. It has unbelievable potential for promulgating wonderful ideas and human connection and sharing, you know, wisdom from, you know, immediately from places, you know, I had to go to the library and look, find a book on something when I was a kid. And now I can ask Siri and the answer is right there, you know, for so many things. So it's an incredible technology. And the curse part of it is that like any technology, it can be misused and it can be used to promulgate destruction and violence and hatred and greed and judgment and, you know, fantasies and all kinds of unreality and lies. And what it speaks to for me in the really big picture is, and this is really where I think we are as a human race, not just as Americans, but certainly as Americans, that we have incredible intelligence. We have incredible powers of creativity and inventiveness. You know, we've created airplanes. We've created computers. We can talk to people on the other side of the world. We can talk to people, you know, in a rocket ship to the moon. We can transplant organs. You know, we can build incredible physical structures of architecture. And, you know, we can do amazing things. And I think we're at this place in the evolution of the species, actually, where we have to decide if just because we can do something, if we should. Just because we can build nuclear weapons, should we? Just because we can detonate them, should we ever consider doing that? And I think that's really where we are, that we have to become healthy as human beings and as voters and as people who have influence, or, you know, on whatever scale, whether you influence one person or 10 million people, you know, are we using our influence for the sustainability of the human race? Are we using our influence for the good of people, or are we causing massive suffering? I mean, look at the wars going on in the world today. It's unfathomable, the suffering that we can cause one another. And even here in America, we don't have an active war going on, but there are many people who are targeted for abuse and neglect and judgment and injustice and discrimination. And that's because of people in positions of authority and maybe a mass contagion of unhealthy mental health, making decisions that are actually very, very injurious. And we have to know that people who are hurt by other people, and this all comes straight out of my experience as a psychotherapist, I'm not saying anything that probably that most psychotherapists don't know, that when people are hurt and when they have no recourse to justice or to escape from being hurt by other human beings or being discriminated against or being hated or assaulted, they become symptomatic. They're going to have symptoms, just like if someone breaks a leg, they're going to have symptoms because their body is hurt. When our hearts are hurt, when our minds are invaded, when our boundaries are invaded, when we're physically assaulted, we're going to become symptomatic. And then what we do as a society, unfortunately, is we often blame people for their symptoms. People become really passive, or they become really aggressive, or they become addicted, or they're terrible parents, or they fail to thrive in their places of business and they can't make a living, or they fail out of school. And then we target them as if they're deficient human beings, rather than looking at what happened to them. How did it happen that this person has lost their way? You know, is struggling, is in pain, is symptomatic, is acting out or acting in. And that's what psychology is designed to address, is to get to the roots of our wounds that are generating our most dysfunctional beliefs and behaviors.
That's all very interesting. And, you know, it got me thinking about this thing about like empathy and compassion, like empathy and compassion towards others. You know, maybe I'm being very idealistic here, but like, if there's a way that we can actually, you know, teach this to people on a much broader scale, because, you know, for someone who is creating stuff or someone who is relating to other people in society at large, you know, for them to consider other people, then they must have some type of empathy and compassion towards others. But it's what we have these problems. The reason we have some of these problems is because some people do not necessarily have much of that empathy or compassion.
Right.
It's like, right. How can that be, you know, you may be taught or ingrained on a larger scale? And it's something I'm thinking about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, you use the word, is it idealistic? And maybe it is idealistic. I don't know if, you know, if that's the word we want to put on it. But yes, I think we have to be idealistic. I think we have to actually dream a different dream for this country, that it's not all about wealth. It's not all about sexual prowess. It's not all about authority and the ability to control or righteousness, because those are the things that are killing us. Those are the things that are hurting people. And so I think we have to have, you know, an ideal of love and belonging and empathy and compassion. And one of the best ways to build that is, there are two things. And of course, there's probably 100 things, but I'm going to name a couple of things. And one of them is to heal our own wounds. When people have a chance to heal the hurt that happened to them, they are much less likely, number one, to be attracted to people who will hurt them again, and they're much less likely to inflict that pain on themselves and others. When people have a chance to heal, their hearts become accessible to them. They feel empathy for themselves and for other people. They're much more cooperative. They're much less judgmental. Are we perfect? No. You know, we'll probably always be on a growth path as long as we live. I don't know anybody who isn't. But I've never seen anyone that I've worked with in all the years that I've been a therapist who's had a chance to heal who has become more violent or destructive or hateful. It just does not happen. And so healing our own wounds is the best access to breaking the cycle of divisiveness and otherness and violence and assault and discrimination and all of the things that we're doing right now that are so unjust to so many people.
Or maybe for people who can go to therapy or for people who might not want to go to therapy, in what ways could people start doing that? And, you know, on a day-to-day level, it's like the way I would brush my teeth to make to have good dental hygiene. In what way can, you know, I as a person or anyone start doing that for themselves?
I mean, I think there's many things that a person can do. I mean, therapy isn't the only answer. It's just a really good answer with the right therapist at the right time, you know, with a good modality. It's a good answer to really getting to the heart of what sets people up to be dysfunctional or abusive or neglectful of themselves or others in their own lives. But without that, I mean, we can all just, if we can, and it's when people really can't do any of these things that it lets us know that the injuries are probably really need help that's beyond what a person can do for themselves. But there's many things we can do for ourselves. You know, do what you love, for one thing. You know, feed yourself good food. If you love art, feed yourself art. If you love music, sing, dance, you know, listen to music. We have to feed life-giving, creative things to ourselves. And for many people who don't have access to healing with other people, their passion is a form of healing. Connection to nature, connection to animals, taking care of children. Any place where your heart opens, where you feel love, where you feel creative, where your mind's on fire with creative ideas, those are all healing modalities. Just being of service to other people. And I don't mean that from a place of like, you know, self-sacrifice or, you know, some really wounded place, but sometimes just really getting out there and being of service to other people fills our own hearts. And we feel like we have meaning and purpose in our lives. There's so many ways to approach this, but really on a very, very down-to-earth, grounded daily basis, we can all just be nicer to each other. We can say hello and smile to someone we don't know. We can ask somebody how their day's going and actually care about the answer, you know, and we can really just take responsibility for, am I being the person in the world that I think I want other people to be for me? Am I being kind? Am I being patient? Am I being understanding? Do I actually care about what happens to you in your life? Or am I so preoccupied with myself that you don't exist for me? Am I generous? Can I, you know, when I know, I just know these little things, like when somebody, you walk into the room and somebody says, oh, you look so great in blue. You know, it's just a little thing. It takes nothing. It's free. But it's like we see each other. Oh, you know, you're such a good singer. I love your voice. These things are free. And we're sort of programmed to believe that everything we need is out of range financially. It's not. Love is free.
I exist on social media in some ways. And then it's like people kind of do not take that belief that actually love is free. And it's very funny that they think that love has to involve a lot of financial things of like, you know, be financial investment. And it's as though people feel as though, some people feel as though that they're not worthy of love if they do not have a certain type of finance or, you know, and it's a very, you know, it's something that's been widespread that people just talk about, and sometimes I look at it and I laugh.
I think we're very conditioned in America, and I don't know how it is in other countries because I really don't know, but I think we're very conditioned in America to see love, the word love, as belonging to women and weak and feminine and girly, when in fact we actually all want love more than anything else. I don't think there's a human being on this planet who isn't born wanting love and belonging and really feeling acceptance and valuing. And then we're trained out of that by the way we're treated by other people. You know, we're taught sometimes that it's girly or weak to talk about love. And I think that's one of the big reasons why emotionally we're in such a pickle in our country and in the world, because love has to be part of the conversation. Belonging has to be part of the conversation. Safety, there's no safety without love and belonging. You know, I mean, you could have a truce, but real safety comes with a sense that I belong here. And because I belong here and I belong to you and you belong to me, I don't want to hurt you. That's where safety comes from. And we're being taught that safety comes from bigger weapons and bigger bank accounts, when in fact, the only thing that will ever make us safe is safe people.
Yeah. Even going back to a point that you made earlier, a few minutes ago, it's a thing where you're trying to say that sometimes it's belonging to just, you know, feeling love and say just by belonging. And it reminds me of certain times in my life where me going out to volunteer makes me feel really alive. You know, right. It feels as though I've talked to people, I've helped people, or I just belong to something, and it just makes me feel less alone and less lonely and something like that. Yeah. And it seems as though sometimes if we can step out of ourselves and stop seeing only ourselves, then it just makes life even more happy.
I think we suffer from great loneliness in the United States. I think loneliness is epidemic, and people are trying to fill the void of an actual loving, caring human relationship with their phones, with social media, with their clothing, with their wealth, with their cars, with looking good, with climbing some kind of ladder. And there's nothing wrong with striving for success. There's nothing wrong with that. But if we're missing the personal connection and the personal relevance that we can feel with other people, then we're really missing like the core of what makes it run. And that's why I think we're so out of control.
Yeah. This is a quick tangent here, but I wanted to like get your perspective on, because I know that, because I am in the field of like software and AI and all, and it's like, I see certain things like AI therapist or AI, you know, talk to an AI, feel better, AI girlfriend, AI boyfriend. In fact, you know, to you, what do you think, to what role do you think AI can ever help a person as a therapist? You know. Like,
well, I have to honestly say I'm probably not the best person to ask, just because I really am not super familiar with AI. But I will say a couple things. One is there's no replacement for an actual human being. There's simply no replacement for an actual human being. I don't believe that there is. And I think the things that come closer to that are like animals and nature and, you know, and creativity and things like that. But I don't think that AI will ever be able to replace what a human being can give. And my one real experience with AI, and honestly, that's why I say I'm not an expert in this, and there's probably people you could talk to who could give you a bigger perspective on it. But I had done a podcast, and the person who was uploading to my website, without my asking him, and it was fine, he just went on AI and he Googled one of the topics I was talking about on my interview, and he just printed out this whole big thing that he got off of AI on one of the topics I had spoken about. And I knew immediately it was AI, even though I have no familiarity with AI, none, zero. Yeah. But I knew he hadn't written it, and it was actually very good. There was a lot of very accurate information in it. It was very well put together, and there was no person in it. And I could feel that. I could feel that it wasn't written by a person. And I took it off my website because I didn't want it there, but I could feel that. And now I'm not familiar with what AI looks like, and I know it can provide great information. But I guess I just want to say that if we lose each other, who cares? If we lose each other, we're not safe here. And we're at such a crossroads in the evolution of the human race where we have so much ability to destroy life as we know it, with polluting the atmosphere and water and the earth and the air and our weapons of mass destruction, that I think it's really beyond time that we focus on, and I call it high-tech human relations. We want high-tech everything. We want high-tech cars. We want high-tech computers. We want high-tech phones. We want high-tech medicine. We want high-tech science. We want high-tech everything. And it's really time for us to ask for the highest tech human relations. And that's what I think the field of psychology has to offer. And those are just the fundamentals of a healthy family. That's what they are. I call it the answers lying hidden in plain sight.
It's like just talking to people and just doing stuff with people. It's like really, but yeah, it's like all that is fading away, really. Yeah. And it's like we're trying to maybe even optimize for less of that. You know, it's like everybody has much more screens than
people.
Stuff. Yeah. You know, even during like break times in the office, I think break times in the office where people could even sit down to chat together.
Right.
They could watch a video on their phone while they eat.
I know. Yeah. It has to do with that dining room phenomenon. Are we sitting down and like coming back together at the end of the day, or is everybody on a device, or nobody's even at the table at the same time? And I think, you know, not to blame people or shame people, I think we're being conditioned to distract constantly.
You know, I don't know if this is a good, I don't know how to think about this, but it's like, you know, because, you know, we are seeking novelty from the apps or the medias that we're using. It's like, are we not seeing novelty in people, or is it because we do not have curiosity that we might find something interesting in another person? It's like, there's no curiosity that we might find something interesting in relating to people.
Well, I think it's a huge issue. And I think it also speaks to what are we doing with education in our country? How many children go to school and they find themselves in a classroom where they're surrounded by people who are like, you know, really their champions? Oh, you know, like, let me help you with this. I can show you how to do math. And, oh, you're really good at math, or you're great at art. Or, you know, do you know what I mean? Where children are actually encouraged from the very beginning to develop their own strengths, their own leanings. You know, some kids are called to music. Some kids are called to animals. Some kids are just called to, you know, technologies or science or engineering or whatever they're called to. Do we live in a society that actually wants that for everybody? Because when you're fed that at an early age, rather than you have to fit into this mold, no, don't color outside the lines of that picture. Even if you have a different idea of what drawing you want to make, you have to color inside these lines. Then we start to kill off that natural curiosity and self-expression and exploratory, inventive, creative nature that I think we're all born with in some way. And so I think, and that's just one piece, but any part of our culture could encourage that. You know, sometimes I say to myself, like, I think of all the people who have died in Gaza, for instance, and I think, what a tragedy all by itself, without adding any word to that. What a tragedy that we human beings have not gotten beyond this, that we're still trying to kill other people in order to get whatever we think our needs are met. But I think to myself sometimes, how did we know that that one guy over there that got shot wasn't the guy who would have cured cancer? How do we know? We don't know. We're throwing our greatest resource away, which is people. And I had this experience, and you've probably had it too. I was standing in line in the grocery store not long ago, and there was a lady holding a little toddler in her arms, and he wasn't even a toddler. He was probably less than a year old. And he was just staring at me. He was just looking at me. And I looked back at him, and then I started talking to him. You know, first of all, he was just like this. He was just looking. And then I was like, hi, how are you? What a big boy you are. And I'm smiling and I'm chirping at him, and his face, he's just like beaming and, you know, and laughing and smiling at me, you know, just this little open book of love. We all are that. We all are that. We were all that little toddler, that little baby once, just waiting to be loved and received and seen. And it's not too late. It's never too late.
That's a really interesting, and it kind of makes me think about trauma in people and maybe how it changes them and all. And maybe it's a good time. Maybe I should open the book of trauma, of like how you approach the topic in your work and what advice you have for people.
Yeah.
Struggling.
Well, yeah. One of the things that I want to say, because I had sexual abuse in my childhood, and so I know that story firsthand, and I know what the pain of that is, and I know how deep it can go and how devastating it can be on your life. And I think one of the things that I really needed when I started therapy myself was I needed to feel like my pain could be taken seriously. I didn't want anyone to talk me out of it, and I don't mean that I wanted to stay in it. I didn't want it to be minimized. I didn't want to be rushed through the process. I needed to retrieve the self that I was underneath what happened to me. And I needed someone to walk that path with me at my pace, if that makes sense. And that was really, really important to me. And so, because I think we really need to be, we live in a culture that doesn't have a high tolerance for pain. You know, we're pill poppers, and we distract, and we over-medicate, and we, you know, we overcompensate. And I think while no one wants to be in pain, no one does. I don't want to be in pain. There is a certain importance of feeling enough of our pain to actually get to what generated it. It's sort of like the only way around is through. And I think that's one of the reasons why good psychology and good psychotherapy is helpful, because it makes a safe place to go into your darkest places and not feel like you just have to hide them or overcompensate for them or pretend you're above it and beyond it and whatever, which we're not. And so I think that it's really, really important for us to, as a world community, not just America, to really understand that the trauma that people have suffered from other human beings, whether it's sexual or physical abuse or hatred or discrimination or injustice or poverty or whatever it is, that we take it really seriously, and that people will become symptomatic if they don't have help. And it's our responsibility as the family of America to give them that help and try to break those cycles.
Yeah.
And stop basically stop blaming them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Blaming ourselves, really. I don't mean them, as others.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always had this thought, because maybe as someone who I have friends maybe going through some type of stuff, or I see people caring for people who are going through some type of stuff, and how, you know, the person you're trying to maybe help through a certain type of problem or mental health issue kind of weighs on the person who is trying to help. You know, maybe I'm trying to help someone and that problem is deeply weighing on me. So it's like, what advice do you have for like people who are trying to create that space for other people and care for them, and like how can they also navigate those problems with the other person and also take care of their own mental well-being? And
are you talking about professionals or just like the average person?
Just like every day person. Right. Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, I think there's ways to be supportive as a friend, for instance, to just really listen, you know, to be, you know, sometimes I have felt very honored with other people when they open their hearts to me, you know, when I'm just the person they want to download whatever's going on with it. It feels like an honor just to be there with them. I don't necessarily imagine I can fix it. I might have an experience I want to share that I think will be meaningful. But basically, the first step is just really being a good listener, being an empathic listener, being someone who actually cares. And then, of course, if you have something to offer, offer it without any strings attached to it. You know, the person will take your offer or they won't. But, you know, depending on whether it's right for them or they're open to it or whatever. But I think it's not so much about, and sometimes it really is like, you know, I have a great person you could talk to. I have a friend who was recently diagnosed with cancer, and I know a really good therapist who survived cancer. And so I made that referral. Whether they follow up on it or not, I don't know. But I offered that because it felt like a good thing to offer. But I think we have to sort of offer lightly, you know, and know that when a person really begins a healing process, it's their own inner guidance that they want to listen to the most. Not me, not even me as a therapist. Therapy is like a co-collaborative relationship. You know, my job ultimately is to help you get in touch with yourself, right? And your guidance and your wisdom and your intuition and your healing. And then you don't need me anymore. You know, yes. And that's the job, right?
Yeah. So it's still more of just like leading them to where they can just be on pilot mode for themselves in some ways.
Right. And I think in America, and again, there's fabulous people in America. There are millions of people doing very philanthropic and generous and service oriented, you know, volunteer things that never reach the news. So we are a generous, kind population as well as, you know, all the things that sort of, you know, overwhelm us in the news. But I think that people, it's the little things that I think matter on a daily basis. What makes my day? You know, if somebody is really happy to see me, it makes my day. I can give that to another person. You know, there's so many people in America that nobody actually pays any attention to. I have people that I've seen over the years who have never had one person in their life tell them they love them, starting with their parents. You know, we can all be that. We can be that. We can listen a little deeper to other people. You know, you look a little sad today. Are you okay? You know, maybe the person wants to talk about it, maybe they don't. But at least I extended a hand.
Yeah, that's a really good advice for, you know, people, someone like myself or people who want to help others and do good to their small communities and small families and friend groups as well. Yeah, we're running out of time now. So I kind of wanted to ask, you know, say if you had an imaginary mic that most, maybe like a whole of America could hear you now, was one thing you would want to tell them?
Yeah, I guess I would say, please read my book. I would say because I think it's a beginning of a conversation. I don't think it's the whole conversation, but I think it's the beginning of a conversation of really bringing love and safety and belonging and our best mental health into the national spotlight as the big missing piece, because I think it's really the big missing piece in policy practice, politics, society, culture, child rearing, the whole thing. I do. So I'll say that today. Sometimes I say other things, but I'll say that today.
Yeah. Yeah. And so my last question really is the question that everybody answers on this podcast is, what do you think is the meaning of life?
Yeah. I think love is the meaning of life. I think to experience love and to give love is the meaning of life. I think it's why we're all here, and I think it's what we all want.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your time. I'm going to, you know, it's been a really nice podcast with you, episode with you, and it's just like so many things that I, you know, now have to think about, now have to reflect. And I think that's, you know, hopefully that's the case for people who listen to this episode. I'm going to link some of your works and some of your other, I think you have a website, which I'm going to link to this
right,
and for people to check out. So please, if you're listening, check out Billy's blog, check out her books. She has some of her books. And the one right. that's coming up, yeah, America in yeah. Therapy. Yeah.
Therapy. Yeah. Right. Yeah. yeah. And please, therapy, yeah. please read it. Please buy it. Please read it and share it, you know. And again, just like, let's have this conversation as a collective.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Thank you yeah. so much. I really appreciate you. And I really feel very honored to have been on your show. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Pleasure is mine.
Thanks for listening to the end. Don't forget to reach out to me on Instagram or Twitter at Hinted Neuron if you have any questions, comments, or concerns. That's it for me this week. And as always, stay curious.